Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Drop
what you're doing. One of the fundamental aspects of the American concept of law, that is the idea of individual liberty protected by law, is that the government has to justify itself in imposing upon the life, liberty, and property of any individual over whom it claims authority. That's a fairly rudimentary, fairly fundamental concept of law that goes well back into Anglo-Saxon antiquity, back to Runnymede, if not earlier. What's happened over the last 10 years, you can round it up to 10 years, it started before September 11th, actually you can go back to 1994, 1995, there were actually counterterrorism measures that were prototypical of the Homeland Security State that were undertaken during the Clinton administration in the aftermath of the first World Trade Center bombing, which was brought to us courtesy of the CIA and FBI, as most episodes of domestic terrorism are brought to us. But in the aftermath of the first World Trade Center bombing, there was also an attack on the CIA headquarters in January, February 1993. There was an effort made to capitalize on the issue of terrorism in order to bring about many of the same kinds of dangerous enhancements of executive power in the name of fighting terrorism that we see now that are reaching their full malignant fruition under Barack the Blessed. What happened over the last 9 years is that there has been a complete abandonment of the pretense that the government has to ask permission. That is to say that the executive branch of the government has to ask permission of the legislative branch or the judicial branch, let alone, of course, the people who are supposed to be sovereign, to do things that involve the summary termination of individual lives and, of course, the summary disposition of liberty and property. If a president, whoever that president might be, of whichever sex, there are only two of which I'm aware, of whatever ethnic background, whatever religious profession, any time a president, somebody occupying the Oval Office and exercising the powers of the presidency, can order the summary execution of an individual without any kind of recourse or any kind of adversarial proceeding, without a warrant, in other words, that's issued by an independent and hopefully skeptical official representing a countervailing force within the government, you're talking about totalitarianism. That's the amalgamation of all powers in one branch of the government as embodied in one individual who can make these decisions without recourse or appeal or accountability. And that's the position of the Barack Obama administration. I have in my hands here an essay that was published today by the redoubtable Glenn Greenwald of Salon.com. He's one of the most perspicuous and principled defenders of the Bill of Rights in the world of journalism today. He's a former civil liberties attorney. He's a frequent critic of the ACLU for reasons that I find to be sound. He's, by conviction, I would say a left libertarian. He's somebody who tends to adhere to the social agenda of the Democratic Party, but boy, is he expansively and pitilessly critical of the Democratic Party for a very good reason, given the fact that it has the same affliction, that is to say, the dear leader worship syndrome that the Republican Party came down with under the reign of Bush the Dumber. Mr. Greenwald's essay from today's installment of Salon.com is entitled, Obama Argues His Assassination Program is a State Secret. Now, this is a very important and troubling development. This is one of the watershed moments, in my opinion, in the unveiling of a full-blown, fully realized, fully functional totalitarian system in the United States. A few years ago, with the passage of the Military Commissions Act and a couple of other really ominous pieces of legislation, one of them involving the Insurrection Act, another involving the National Guard back in late 2006, just before midterm election, as it turns out, that was a moment, I think, when we reached a critical watershed. And this is at least similar moment. At this point, writes Glenn Greenwald, I didn't believe it was possible, but the Obama administration, has just reached an all-new low in its abysmal civil liberties record. In response to the lawsuit filed by Anwar al-Awlaki's father, Anwar al-Awlaki, and I'm sure I'm butchering the name, is a Yemeni, I believe Yemeni-born U.S. citizen. He's from New Mexico. He has dual citizenship, citizenship by birth in Yemen, and then citizenship by naturalization in the United States. In response to the lawsuit filed by Anwar al-Awlaki's father asking a court to enjoin the president from assassinating his son, a U.S. citizen, without any due process, the administration late last night, according to the Washington Post, filed a brief asking the court to dismiss the lawsuit without hearing the merits of the claims. That's not surprising. Both the Bush and Obama administrations have repeatedly insisted that their secret conduct is legal, but nonetheless urge courts not even to rule on its legality. But what's most notable here is that one of the arguments the Obama DOJ raises to demand dismissal of this lawsuit is, quote, state secrets. In other words, not only does the president have the right to sentence Americans to death with no due process or charges of any kind, but his decisions as to who will be killed and why he wants them dead are state secrets, and thus no court may adjudicate its legality. A very intense case of food poisoning in New York on Tuesday, combined with my traveling home all night last night, prevents me from writing much about this until tomorrow. That's a personal note made by Mr. Greenwald. I'm not disclosing for your benefit some gastrointestinal distress that I've recently suffered, and trust me, after my experience a year ago, I do not minimize the significance of gastrointestinal distress. Let me skip forward here in the essay. If the president has the power to order American citizens killed with no due process, and to do so in such complete secrecy that no courts can even review his decisions, then what doesn't he have the power to do? Think of that for a second. There is no more severe imposition on life, liberty, and property than summary execution. Think of this as well. This is a maxim I've quoted on many occasions. No doubt I'll quote it again on many others. What was Vladimir Lenin's definition of Soviet ruling philosophy, if you want to torture the word philosophy into applying in this context? The scientific scientific dictatorship, as he defined it, is nothing other than this: power without limit resting directly on force. Power without limit resting directly on force. Unrestricted by rules, completely unimpeded by laws. That's one version of an English translation of Lenin's definition of the scientific dictatorship that the Soviet Union was supposed to represent. In other words, acting as the figurehead for the ruling oligarchy in the Soviet Union, Vladimir Lenin and each of the people who succeeded to the same position in that, I was going to call it a hierarchy, I think I'll use C.S. Lewis's term, lorarchy, that ruling criminal elite, claimed the power, unimpeded by laws, unrestrained by rules, to dispose of any individual or individuals in any quantity that they saw fit, because they embodied the law. That was a principle of homeland security doctrine, if you will, that was enshrined during the reign of George W. Bush, and now Barack Obama is bringing it to fruition. We'll talk about this on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and I'd love to hear from you.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
1-866-986-6397 is our call number, 866-986-6397 on the Liberty News Radio Network. I'm talking about a brief that was filed last night by the Obama administration in which it made the remarkable but tragically predictable claim that even to ask for a judge to enjoin an effort by the president summarily to execute an American citizen who has been designated a terrorist suspect, even to ask that much, is to violate the expansive and apparently limitless power of the president under the supposed war doctrine, the supposed doctrine of war powers. and that even requiring disclosure of the evidence against an individual who's been targeted for summary execution is a violation of something called the state secrets privilege. There is no state secrets privilege under the United States Constitution. Everything that the government can do, can legally do, is specified in that document. There are no implied powers. There are no emanations from penumbra. There are no shadowy, tenebrous, concealed, secretive grants of authority. Everything the government, the federal government, can do, and a lot of the things that the state governments can do, can be found in the black letter text of the Constitution. Now, I've said before, and I'm in the habit of reiterating myself, and I consider something to be of tremendous importance, and this is one of those instances, that the Constitution represents the starting point for a conversation about how to protect individual liberties. It's a fascinating and commendable document, but it is not the be-all and end-all of liberty. In some senses, as a matter of fact, the Constitution represents a derogation from a far superior system of limited decentralized powers that existed under the Articles of Confederation. I don't think that you're a real constitutionalist unless you have a sort of winsome, wistful desire to see a restoration of the much more decentralized system that existed under the Articles of Confederation. But taking our situation from the point of what emerged from Philadelphia in 1787, as amended necessarily with the Bill of Rights in 1791, the cold fact remains that nothing in the Constitution authorizes the federal government and the executive, the chief executive of the federal government, summarily to execute an American citizen, or summarily to execute anybody. As a matter of fact, when you talk about the war powers in general, war being, of course, an enterprise in mass homicide, that's something that the Congress has to declare specifically. There is a specific formal procedure for doing so. You have to have, in other words, specific permission and specific authorization anytime the federal government gets involved in the business of killing people. I'll talk about this in more detail anon. We have callers waiting very patiently. Robert from Colorado has joined us. Good evening, Robert. How are you doing?
Well, after hearing that little bit of news, not so well.
You got a feeling.
Out of control government that's just making up rules as they go along.
Indeed. They seem to be pulling them out of their emunctory aperture.
I want to go back to your soliloquy last week about Hinterest, then we'll move forward. Did a little research on him. Just to clean up that part about his name change. Yeah, he was born John Allen Hendricks. His father was named James Allen Al Hendricks. When he was born in 42, I think, Senior Hendricks was in the Army. At age two, Senior Hendricks was discharged from the Army, then came home, decided he didn't like John Allen, and changed it to James Marshall, James being Senior Hendricks' first name, Marshall being his brother Leon's middle name, and that's where James Marshall comes from.
Another I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
I think I found out. I'm sorry.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that about him.
Yeah. Something else I think I found out about Hendricks was that he didn't pick up the guitar until age 15. Now, if he died at age 27, that means he would have had maybe half a dozen years to master that thing.
That's terrifying.
That is.
He was a latent learner.
I guess. So what do you think? What was it about him that made him the best there ever was? Was it? I know he was a big guy and had big hands and long fingers.
Yes.
Was it just he could just swallow the frets? Was it just a gift from God? What was it? What put him where he was?
Of the opinion that anytime somebody is an innovator, you're dealing with a divine gift. And so, like I said, he's a latent learner. He's somebody who obviously was hardwired for excellence on that instrument. And he had an overdeveloped intelligence quotient for music as expressed through the guitar. I know the sort of personality we're talking about. There's a fellow from England by the name of Guthrie Govan who literally terrifies me every time I see him play because there is no impedance between his head and his fingers. He can play anything that occurs to him, and he's got an incredibly well-stocked imagination. And Hendricks was pretty much the same way, but he was a pioneer in doing many of the techniques that people like Guthrie Govan have taken and refined to absurd levels. There's another fellow from Australia. He's 19 years old. I can't remember his name, but he plays Travis-style acoustic guitar. And for the life of me, I've never seen anybody, including Tommy Emmanuel, who's another Aussie who's a virtuoso in that specific type and technique of guitar. I've never seen anybody play the way this kid did at 16. I don't know how old he was when he took it up. I would assume he would have been a Mozart-level prodigy playing when he was 4 or 5 years old. But often you're dealing with people who just are, if you will, out of the box, loaded with whatever spiritual and intellectual software would be required in order to turn them into historic caliber virtuosos. And I think that's the case with Jimi Hendrix. And imagine the waste that would have ensued if he would have pursued a career as an airborne ranger, as he intended to in the early 60s. I think that he was injured in a parachuting training accident. And he ended up being given a medical discharge within about a year or so of enlisting in the Army. Now think of what would have happened if he would have ended up bleeding to death in some rice paddy in Vietnam. Think of the waste. Now think of the waste that actually happened.
Yeah.
When you had tens of thousands of very wonderful American youth whose lives were blighted and wasted and ruined in that pointless conflict, and you had something like 2 million Vietnamese who were killed, too.
Yeah, heavy is the head that wears the crown. But yeah. Let's move on. As you may or may not know, about a week or so ago, the third federal court, I think it was, ruled that Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the ban is unconstitutional. D.V. Kidd kind of chatted about this on her show last week. That's funny because, A, I didn't know the Constitution spoke to being of the gay persuasion, having the right to be in the military. B, the military, last time I checked, is voluntary, which means you don't have to be there anyway.
That's true.
So I don't get the constitutional angle on that deal.
Well, there's not a constitutional angle on that deal. I mean, Congress has plenary authority to define the rules and regulations of conflict in the military. That's simply cut and dried, once again, black letter, clear, unambiguous text in the Constitution. There are no qualifications to the power of Congress to defining the rules that govern the comportment and the conduct of people in the military. Whatever you think of the policy, it's well within Congress's constitutional purview, and it's an act of staggering judicial perversity to suggest otherwise. You know, when I wrote a piece about this several months ago, I pointed out that a lot of the people on the right who are talking about this issue are arguing the wrong set of issues, because they're approaching the military as if we're talking about some kind of a sanctified and exalted calling. And I said they're spending too much time focusing on who's in the military rather than what is being done with the military. And we shouldn't even really have a standing army.
I agree.
That's something that not many people appreciate. We shouldn't have a standing army. We should have a Navy, although I think the Navy should be much more constrained than it is. Robert, do you want to stick through the break?
I think I'm good. I'll let you roll. I'll catch you next
time. Okay, thanks a lot, Robert. God bless. Good to hear from you. This is World Great Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We have another caller waiting. When we get back, we'll hear from him, and I'd like to hear from you, so stick around. Here's a really interesting and somewhat disturbing reaction to the Obama administration's brief last night, talking about the idea that even requiring the president to justify the summary execution of an American citizen, somehow an imposition on his powers and a violation of the so-called state secrets privilege. 2 weeks ago, the New York Times' Charlie Savage, who writes about national security issues, wrote about the possibility of the Obama administration raising the so-called state secrets privilege argument. I'm once again reading from Glenn Greenwald's piece from today's edition of Salon.com. Mr. Savage quoted an individual characterized by Glenn Greenwald as the far-right, Bush-supporting, executive power-revering lawyer David Rivkin as follows. The government's increasing use of the state secrets doctrine to shield its actions from judicial review has been contentious. Some officials have argued that invoking it in the Aulaki matter, about which so much is already public, would risk a backlash. David Rivkin, a lawyer in the White House of President George H.W. Bush, echoed that concern. Quote, I'm a huge fan of executive power, but if someone came up to you and said the government wants to target you and you can't even talk about it in court to try to stop it, that's too harsh even for me, he said. That's really interesting. I've interviewed David Rivkin. As a matter of fact, I interviewed him about 12 years ago. I wasn't able to get him on camera at the time, but he was a critic of the proposed International Criminal Court, which is now a fully functioning arm of the United Nations. And the International Criminal Court, of course, represents a perfectly terrible idea. It claims universal jurisdiction, compulsory jurisdiction, and it claims the power to prosecute people in this world tribunal for supposed offenses against the so-called core statutes represented or rather adjudicated by the ICC, that would be war crimes, crimes of aggression, genocide, and there's one other whose name I can't remember right now. But they claim the power to arrest and extradite and try people before this, once again, world tribunal for acts committed within the boundaries of a given nation state. So, for instance, if I were accused of fomenting crimes against humanity here in Payette, Idaho, in the United States of America, the United Nations claims the right to compel the government of the United States to extradite me to stand trial in Geneva, actually, no, in The Hague, it's in the Netherlands, not in Switzerland, for my supposed crimes. And they've already done this type of extraterritorial enforcement with respect to the various ad hoc tribunals that were set up for Rwanda and for the Balkans and so forth. Rivkin was a critic of that. He thought that the ICC represented a type of arbitrary power that was completely inappropriate and dangerous, and yet he endorsed the idea of extraterritoriality being exercised by Washington, but he thinks that Obama has gone too far in this instance. I'd be interested to see if he would have thought that this would have been an assertion of power too far if John McCain were in the White House. I suspect, given the fact that this guy's a Republican partisan, he might not be so emphatically opposed to it. James from South Carolina has joined us. Good evening, James. Welcome to the program.
I talked to you a couple of weeks ago. I asked you about the National Guard.
And, yes.
The federalization, I suppose, of the National Guard. Well, I looked it
yes.
up, at least on the Internet, and what I got out of it, there has to be a catastrophe or a disaster declared or something like that for the president to take control of the National Guard. If he takes control of the National Guard now, does that come under the designation that we're engulfed in terrorism and in Iraq and Afghanistan? Is that why he invokes this or why he can do
it? What could happen is that he could invoke the existing states of emergency that have been declared post 9/11. As a matter of fact, he just recently reiterated or reauthorized the post September 11th national emergency. And in the event that he identifies or at least asserts the existence of combinations that would undermine the power of the federal government and the national security of the United States, he could nationalize the National Guard. He could federalize the National Guard to that end. And the thing that I find really upsetting, James, is that with respect to what's going on in Arizona right now, you've got people actually begging the Obama administration to federalize the Arizona National Guard or to federalize other guard elements and send them to Arizona. It seems to me like they're walking into a trap there. Just yesterday, or within the last couple of days, there was a state legislator here in Idaho who suggested sending members of the Idaho National Guard to Arizona. And presumably he would do so, or this would be accomplished, by way of some kind of a decree from President Obama. And this is the sort of thing that makes me think these people aren't running the math as to what they're proposing, because under the post-2006 arrangements, what they're doing is they're basically asking Obama to create his own little private Praetorian Guard in the name of protecting the border or in the name of dealing with terrorism or some other existing emergency. But on the basis of what's already been proclaimed in terms of natural emergencies, there's enough supposed or asserted authority that would justify the federalization of the National Guard, as I understand the proposition. And they're trying to make this as opaque as possible, unfortunately.
Well, doesn't the Congress have to agree to that? I mean, I think 6 months ago they agreed to extend the privilege that the president has.
I don't think the Congress necessarily has a role in this, at least in the way that it's been organized. You're familiar with what happened on January 11th when this executive order creating a so-called Council of Governors was issued. And the purpose of this council, the purpose of the Council of Governors was basically to meet at the call of the president or a designated executive branch official to supervise and synchronize the integration of the National Guard and Reserve units into the larger Homeland Security system. And what I think's happening is that this is becoming sort of an off-the-shelf type of an operation. And even if there is a role for Congress, and I'm not sure that there is, generally what happens is that if the president sets in motion some kind of a military initiative, either domestically or overseas, Congress will almost never interdict this by cutting off funding or refusing to fund the initiative, because we start hearing this chorus of people talking about how scandalous it is that they don't have the back of our troops, that they're stabbing the troops in the back, and so on and so forth. And so once they're deployed by the president in whatever capacity, Congress just basically tags along and plays its scripted role.
So the president has the right, just out of fiat, he can proclaim a catastrophe, whether there is or not, a disaster.
Yes.
Whether there is or not.
As I read the legislation from 2006 and the amendment put forth by Leahy and then the executive order from last January, it does appear that the president can, by executive decree, federalize the National Guard and order them hither and yon here within the United States and deploy them as he sees fit. And I think that there are too many people who are receptive to this idea as long as it's used for the purpose of border enforcement or something having to do with counterterrorism. They're not understanding, I think, the larger implications of what that would mean.
Well, that as far as the National Guard's concerned, I don't see how that could supersede the state's right to do that, the governor's right to control the National Guard. Maybe it would have to be challenged, but I don't see how that's possible, really.
Well, there are a lot of things that constitutionally are not possible that are being done right now. This would be just one entry on that large and unfortunately growing list. But you're right, in terms of the constitutional principles, the National Guard should be the militia of a given independent state. That is to say, the select militia, not the general militia. The unorganized militia would be basically all able-bodied people except for public officials, as George Mason pointed out. But I think that what's happened is that I believe back in 1904 or 1911, I'll have to go back and check, there was a measure passed which began the process of turning the formerly independent state National Guards into parts of the regular military. And it took them a number of decades, but I think that was consummated in 2006. They're in everything but name, just another branch of what the Pentagon controls.
Well, there have been some people to advocate the resurrection of the concept of the militia. I mean, if the National Guard is at the beck and call of the president for no reason, it does seem that the states are left kind of naked. I mean, they could.
Yes, it does.
The president could send, in the midst of a hurricane or something, he could send the National Guard to, you know, somewhere out of the state if he wanted to, apparently.
Yep. Well, there are recent precedents for that. James, do you want to stick through the break?
Okay,
James will join us on the other side of the break. We're talking about the federalization of the National Guard. This is Liberty News Radio. I'm William Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. there was a time when the units called the National Guard now were referred to as the Home Guard. They were the militia units that appertained to a given independent state. They were considered to be pretty much a select group, the purpose of which was to protect a given state against foreign aggression or internal unrest that would become a threat to life, liberty, and property. That's what happened during the colonial era. That's what happened during the post-colonial era, that blessed interregnum that we refer to as the Articles of Confederation era. And for a while, intermittently from 1791 until the beginning of the 20th century, you had National Guard units that were considered part of the Home Guard. And in many places, they were the police, or they were an extended sheriff's posse. Now the National Guard is considered to be, as far as I can tell on my admittedly inadequate reading of the literature, it's considered to be pretty much fully integrated into the existing military apparatus, and it has increasingly become sort of a plaything at the present. The question is this: under what circumstances now is it possible for the President of the United States, any president, simply to appropriate the National Guard, usurping the power of the state legislatures and the governors of the various states over that Home Guard and use them as his Praetorian Guard? Can this be done in the event of a national emergency? What kind of national emergencies would qualify? Would the post-9/11 national emergency with respect to the threat of terrorism be sufficient? My reading is that that is the case. Now, James from South Carolina has joined us, and he makes the provocative and useful point that if the National Guard is now, at least in principle, the property of the president, then the states are pretty much left naked. And so what can they do in terms of fulfilling the mandate described in the Federalist Papers of protecting the domestic order within the state, having to do with insurrection or crime or life, liberty, and property within the state posed by criminal combinations or posed by usurping national government? And James had mentioned, as I recall, you'd mentioned on the other side of the break that there has been a movement as a result of all this to reinstitute the unorganized militia, to revivify the idea that the body of the public under arms is really the unorganized militia of the United States. Did I summarize your views correctly, James?
That's correct. I was wondering, would the president's power extend to the use of the National Guard within the state of its origin?
I don't see why it wouldn't.
Well, I don't
quite frankly, but
sense.
what I suspect would happen, and by the way, that's one of the things that I find so troubling about what's going on in Arizona. Arizona has a National Guard. A lot of its National Guard is over in Iraq and Afghanistan, more in Afghanistan than Iraq, actually. So they're overseas, and yet people in Arizona are saying, we need troops on the border. Are they saying that they want the Obama administration to take control of their National Guard troops, which presumably is something that Governor Brewer could do, or are they asking for the President of the United States to send National Guard troops from other states to carry out that function? And either of those alternatives strikes me as really quite troublesome, given the fact that the state legislature in Arizona does have the reserve power to use the National Guard to protect the border if that's something that the state legislature deems appropriate and the governor is willing to sign off on. Jan Brewer, as it happens, is a member of Barack Obama's Council of Governors. I think that's a really interesting fact and a potentially troublesome one if you take a look at sort of the inside baseball implications of that relationship. But I don't see why, on the basis of the asserted powers that I referred to with respect to the 2006 Act and the January 11th executive order, that a president couldn't take control of a National Guard unit within the state to which that National Guard unit belongs. And I don't like that one bit, but I can certainly see how that could happen very easily.
Well, when Governor Brewer asked, someone asked to send troops to the border, National Guard, and they were complaining mm-hmm. that they didn't have enough. Were they expecting the president to take National Guard units from other states to send them to Arizona? Is that what they were expecting?
Well, that's, I think, what they were thinking. I know that there have been National Guard units from here in Idaho that have been sent to California and Texas for various border patrol related initiatives and deployments over the last couple of years. And as I mentioned, there's a member of the state legislature who just a couple of days ago suggested that this is something that might be done again, that they might send a portion of the Idaho National Guard to Arizona in order to fortify the border with Mexico. And we already have a third of the National Guard from Idaho serving overseas. The 116th, for instance, just left a couple of days ago, headed to Iraq, to the war that's already over, supposedly. And this is the third or fourth deployment for some of these people. And that's another really good example of what we're talking about here, is that they're using the National Guard now as a global military power projection unit rather than as a home guard to protect the various states of the Union. And that's something that really should be.
As far as you know, has anyone stood up against this? Are there any people of integrity in the Pentagon who have said this is not right? Or
not that I'm aware of right now. I know that 20 years ago or so, Michael Dukakis, when he was governor of Massachusetts, made a very brief and ultimately futile effort to interdict the deployment of Massachusetts National Guardsmen to Honduras, where they were carrying out a support function for what was going on in Nicaragua. And every once in a while, a governor will get up on his hind legs for a little bit and make a fuss, but generally they back down. Because the states right now are just administrative units of Washington. They're just pass-throughs for federal subsidies and tax farmers for the IRS. I mean, the states don't exist anymore as independent polities the way that they used to be. I certainly wish that weren't the case, but I'm constrained to admit that is.
Well, okay. Well, I appreciate your efforts. Keep
okay.
it up, Will.
Thank you. God bless. It's great to hear from you. Yeah, I have to point out that one of my big problems with all of this, whenever we discuss the issue of the National Guard, it's really twofold. The first of which is that, assuming that we're going to have a government of some sort, that's an assumption that I'm willing to entertain right now, because that's the situation that confronts us, not the situation I wish would prevail. I'd rather be dealing as much as possible in a circumstance where human associations defined by commerce, by cooperation, by peaceful mediation of disputes, things of that sort, rather than by coercion. I'd like to minimize coercion in human affairs. Unfortunately, we're saddled with governments. I think that's in large measure a reflection of original sin. There seems to be something about human nature that yields the type of circumstance that is congenial to the growth of this affliction that we call a government. But inasmuch as we're going to have a government, it should be small, it should be local, it should be as helpless as possible, it should be composed of people who are perpetually in a panic over whether they're transgressing the rights of the people they represent, and they should have an acute understanding, as acute an understanding of their precarious situation as that which sees the press of the dinner guests at King Damocles' table, who were seated beneath the proverbial sword that was suspended over their heads by a single frayed thread. That's my model of how government should operate. In that context, there is, I think, a role for a general muster of the armed citizenry for the purpose of turning back aggression from outside or putting down criminal aggression within a given state. But that's not the circumstance that we have right now. And we really haven't had home guards or national guards. And I think national is a misnomer in light of our history here. State militias is what we're talking about. Government state militias. State-run, government-authorized and funded militias. The National Guard, as it exists right now, is much closer to the Prussian concept of a select militia, which is exactly what we were supposed to avoid. And what's even more distressing to me is the fact that the National Guard is getting much more actively involved in routine law enforcement. And I've talked about this before. I don't want to get into detail about it this evening because we've got other things to talk about. But the National Guard, particularly in light of some disclosures that we've read about from Buffalo, New York, just in the last couple of months, the National Guard approaches the war on drugs as a literal war. And I'm glad to see that at least somebody is being candid about this. The war they're waging is a war against the American people, in which the American people are looked upon as enemy combatants in an effort to eradicate a form of chosen individual behavior that wasn't against the law 100 years ago. We're talking primarily about marijuana consumption, as well as consumption of cocaine and opiates and other things that I consider to be robustly unhealthy. But as I never tire of pointing out, when these substances were all perfectly legal 120 years ago, and our country was much more religious and straight-laced for the most part than it is now, we didn't have a population of drug fiends. We did have a large number of alcoholics, and we know what happened when there was an effort made by the government to cure, through coercion, people's penchant for drinking. Just something to think about. But the National Guard, unfortunately, is involved very much in the war to conquer the bloodstream of individual American citizens, and that is just bad news. Thus ends hour one of Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Our call number is 866-986-6397. I am William Grigg. Join my blog online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. We'll be back with hour two in just a couple of minutes, and so I hope to hear from you then. Stick around.